Thank you for inviting me to such a beautiful, historic, and famous university. All my life I've wanted to see Peking University, and now here I am. I can scarcely believe it. All of the cognitive linguists in this series before me told me, Mark, you're just going to love it. It's absolutely wonderful, and indeed I have. Thank you for your patience and your determination and your ability to hang in there. We are now into the 18th lecture in this series, okay? So I want to talk today about the nature of language and where it comes from. And I'm often surprised when I see discussions about the origins of higher-order human cognition. It's often assumed that somehow human beings were in something that's called a state of nature. There they were, and they basically had very little going for them that would distinguish them from any other great ape, except that they had language, right? They would sit around and able to use counterfactual expressions and conditionals and causatives and so on, but they hadn't come up with anything. So they had full language, and then they invented art. Or they had full language, and then they invented law and institutions and universities and so on. I find this very amazing. It doesn't seem to me that a human being could have, or that human society could have, language with all of its amazing imaginative capacities and its ability to configure great networks of meaning, could have had that without having many of the other sorts of things that we think of as aspects of human higher order cognition. And so I think that the answer might be, I ask myself, how could people think like this? How could theorists think like this? How, for instance, could social contract theorists think that there we were in the state of nature and we had language, and then we decided to invent things like contracts and social contracts and so on? Well, the only thing I can think is that when we look at the history of, you know, the last few thousand years, which is very little, you see that, you know, there used to be a little less. We sometimes invent a little more and a little more and a little more. And you can imagine maybe there was a time when there wasn't any of it there. You had lots of human beings with higher order cognition, but you didn't have any of these things. So let's see that again. You know, here we are way up here, and you just sort of imagine that you could take it all away, but that human language was sort of there at the beginning. Now, I don't think that's right, so I'm going to give a different kind of story. Where is language, and what is language, and how did it come from? And the rudiments of this story, and most of the details, are in a book I published with Gilles Fauconnier. Just mentioned The Way We Think, Conceptual Blending, and the Mind's Hidden Complexity. So if you want to see most of the references for this talk, you can go there, or you can go to blending.stanford.edu, where all of your questions will be answered. You'll see hundreds of papers on blending and so on. So look, there are a lot of stories about where language came from, and I won't take any time with them, because you're familiar with them. There are various nativist kinds of theories that suddenly something happened and human beings had language because of some dramatic genetic change that changed them in only one way, namely suddenly they had language. The idea that language is a modular system. Now, these two things don't have to go together, but sometimes they do. Co-evolutionary notions like Terry Deacon's, that the brain and language were gradually developed together since Australopithecus 2.5 million years ago. Associative and learning theories, according to which human beings have enormous and wonderful abilities for statistical extraction, and they, as it were, develop an understanding of these patterns. I'm going to present something different, and I want to say at the beginning of this, we have to be careful to just be aware of two possible fallacies that human reasoning often falls into, especially when we're thinking about human cognition. One of these is what I call the cause-effect isomorphism fallacy. So it's sometimes the case that we see a big effect in the world. And when there's a big effect, something very different happens. And when we see that, we think, oh, the cause must be a big thing. So if the effect is sudden and noticeable, well, the cause must have been sudden and noticeable, as opposed to gradual, very, very gradual. Well, those of you who have been following these lectures will remember that I've talked an awful lot about our need to compress things to human scale so we can hold them. And it's very common for us to compress the cause and the effect together and hold them together. This gives us simple little stories for how the world works. So, for example, I see this as one thing, and that's the effect, right? And you might ask, well, why do I see this as one thing? And people will look at me and say, well, that's just amazing. The reason you see it as one thing is that it is one thing. See, that's a compression of the cause and the effect. You think the cause is just the same thing as the effect, right? Now, in fact, that's not at all the reason that you see this as one thing. All the different aspects of it are processed in very different places in the brain. They are not brought together anatomically, but it seems as if it just goes straight from here, right into my brain. Why do I see it as one thing? Because it's one thing. So the effect is the same thing as the cause, but it's, although that's very good for our thinking, it helps us think, it's important always to be careful in thinking about scientific questions that you're not conflating the cause and the effect. So if language is suddenly here and human beings have it, that doesn't mean that there was some sudden cause that made language appear. Another one is the function organ isomorphism fallacy. This is, people are a little more aware that this is frequently a fallacy. This is where you think, well, you know, human beings have tongues and they speak with them, so the tongue is an organ for speaking, right? It's an organ with a function. You know, of course, primates and mammals and so on had fabulously articulated tongues long before they spoke. Or you look at an opossum, which is an animal that hangs by its tail from a tree. You say, oh, well, so the tail evolves in order to make it possible for the opossum to hang. The tail is a hanging organ. But no, there were tails long before opossums would hang from trees. We have to be careful of these as we think. I'm going to propose a theory that escapes both of these fallacies, or escapes both of these problems. It doesn't have them as part of its reasoning. I'm going to argue that language is a product. Actually, it's a byproduct of the origin of the evolution of modern cognition. In other words, human beings were anatomically modern. They were a great ape, and they had a certain ability, like many other apes and mammals have, to do various kinds of mental operations. And one of these operations is blending, its conceptual integration. And you can trace rudimentary blending all the way back into early mammals, at least, right? And it has been evolving gradually since that time. And cognitively modern human beings had one extra little step in blending. They got to the highest form of blending, which we will call double scope blending. And once they hit double scope blending, then they had a capacity to manage large conceptual integration networks that other species are not able to manage. And this ability made it possible for us to have art, music, advanced social cognition, advanced tool use, fashion, mathematical insight, scientific discovery, language, right? And that these things came up together, supporting each other, not because one of them came up and then it made the others possible, but because double scope blending evolved as one more gradual step, and that made all these other things possible. So in this story, preview of coming attractions, in this story, there's a long, gradual evolution of mental ability, conceptual integration. Gradual evolution of the ability from early mammals up to us. And then when you get to this step, language becomes possible. So the effect, language, is fairly sudden in the history of human beings, in my view, is fairly sudden. And it's a big deal. It's a singularity. But the causes are not sudden or singular. The causal development has been going on for a very, very long time. Right? So conceptual integrations, human beings have a remarkable ability to perform a basic mental operation we call conceptual integration or blending. In particular, what really separates us so dramatically from other species is we have the ability to do the most advanced form. They can do rudimentary blending, but we can do the most advanced form. Other species have the ability, as I said, to do rudimentary blending, but it's been around a long time. And the evolution of double scope blending made human singularities possible, language, art, science, advanced tool use, and so on. And these these human singularities are the product of double scope blending. And they've been invented by cognitively modern human beings in cultural time, not in evolutionary time. So that doesn't mean overnight, but cultural invention moves so much faster than biological invention, as I discussed in the first lecture. Biological evolution takes a long time. You get differences in different species. Cultural evolution just swamps it out. Once you get to the point of double scope blending, then you can develop new meanings without need of new biology. So we've seen this story of double scope blending many times. There's one mental space. I'm just symbolizing it with a yellow circle. Somebody's thinking about one thing, maybe getting on the plane and thinking about getting on the plane. And in another scene, this person is thinking about maybe sometime he was in Beijing and had roast duck or duck soup or zongsha on Dragon Boat Festival Day or something like that. You know, wonderful, wonderful time and great conversation. And makes a connection between those two spaces. Namely, the plane is going to move the traveler someplace new and exciting. And over in the space of thinking about Beijing, all of those wonderful Chinese students took the professor's mind to a new place. See? And that's a kind of metaphoric or analogical connection. And you've seen very simple ones. A very simple one, for instance, is over here there's a person getting on the plane. And over there, a person is having a conversation with Chinese students. And that's just an identity connector. But it's a very important one. So some of these connectors seem very simple. Some of these connectors are very complicated. And we've seen the way in which blending networks bring in previous blending networks that culture has provided for us. So I already have the idea of conversation as a conveyance that moves me along, and I'm pulling that in. But I can connect these two by selective projection. And in the blend, I can say conversation is the magic jet plane that takes you places you never thought you could go. Right? And suddenly, you know, I have a new kind of conception. We've seen many, many of these. Now, I'm going to be talking about things that are so basic that sometimes it's hard to see that they are blends. So I want to start off, as always, with a couple of really weird blends, just so you can see them. There is a poem by Craig Rayne. Craig Rayne is a poet, obviously. And this is called A Martian Sends a Postcard Home. So this Martian comes to Earth and then sends a postcard home about what's on Earth. And says, Caxtons, that's a word for the Martian uses for birds. Or, I'm sorry, for books. Because Caxton invented the book, or was one of the inventors of the book. Caxtons are mechanical birds with many wings, and some are treasured for their markings. So this person has looked at a book here and wondered what it could possibly be, and seen that it has lots of pages and is trying to figure out what it could be and thinks, oh, this is a bird, except it has many wings instead of two, right? And some are treasured for their markings. There's illustration inside. And they cause the eyes to melt or the body to shriek with pain. So this is crying, the eyes melt, and laughing is the body shrieking, or to shriek without pain. I have never seen one fly, but sometimes they perch on the hand. See, so here's this Martian who looks at somebody holding something he's never seen before, wonders what it is, makes a connection between that and birds, and gets a blend where this is a kind of bird, but not like any of the kinds of birds he knows. Now this thing has many wings, and it perches on the hand, right? Okay. He goes all the way through talking about this. Now, what I'd like to point out is this Martian has double scope blending, right? This Martian can do blending. So it's just like you, in a way. It's just that this Martian is doing very weird ones because the Martian is from a different culture. And that's what culture is. We go into different cultures, and they have used blending to put together different integration networks. So talking about conceptual integration does not solve the problem for you of analyzing linguistic constructions or where they come from, because you have to analyze how different cultures used conceptual integration to come up with the different languages that they did and how they evolved. Okay, so what features should a theory of the origin of language have? Now, I want to say that, unfortunately, fortunately, I work on living human beings. I can interview them, I can take data, I can run experiments, I can look at data, things like that, and I like to do that. There is no corpus for language 50,000 years ago. So I can't do a corpus analysis, and that's really a shame. Now, I have applied to the United States National Science Foundation for them to give me a time machine so I can go back 50,000 years and do the science that needs to be done, but for some reason they have not granted what I want. But I wish I could, okay? So we don't have data from the period that we're talking about. We don't have brains either. Brains don't survive. So in a way, it's kind of odd to talk about a theory of the origin of language. But we can do what we can, and there are lots of them out there, and none of them is like this, so we offer this one as a rival hypothesis. Well, for starters, I think we need our theory, whatever it would be, to recognize the singularity of language. There is no evidence at all that anybody has ever been able to produce that I know of, and I've gone looking, for sustained intermediate stages of language phylogenetically. By which I mean we had no evidence that, 25,000 years ago there was a language that consisted only of three-word combinations and only one clause, and they only had 1,000 words, And they hadn't evolved conditional expressions, and they hadn't evolved negative expressions or anything like that. There's no evidence whatever that there were ever any sustained intermediate stages of language. All of the world's languages we know have immense complexity. Now, that's remarkable. All of the dialects, all of the language have immense grammatical complexity. So let's not dismiss that. I mean, why couldn't five of them somewhere have been just simple little grammars instead of the ones we've got? We don't find that. We also find no evidence we find no evidence in the past of it, and we don't find any evidence of it now. So these are just facts. I could be defeated on this right now by somebody, anybody in the world. Walk through the door and show me that you have found a language somewhere in the west of China, up in the hills, that is grammatically extremely simple. Just go ahead, right? It's a challenge open to the world. It's not going to happen, I don't think. I also think we have to avoid the cause-effect isomorphism, to say that because language is singular and seems to come up relatively suddenly in the long phylogenetic descent, therefore there must have been some sudden and highly spectacular cause for it, just because that's not the way evolution operates. We don't, in the main, evolution works gradually, right? And as François Jacob, the great theorist, said, Evolution is a tinker. It takes what it's got in the shop and adjusts it just a little and gets something that's useful and that's supported, right? So someone who wants a spectacular genetic spontaneous event as a source of language has a lot of a burden of explanation on that, on their side. I would look for a continuous path of evolutionary change over a very long period as the cause of language, right? That's how evolution usually works. The path should be a plausible adaptive story evolutionarily. That is, each change along the path has to be adaptive in itself, regardless of where the path ultimately led. And this is just, you know, evolutionary biology 101. Evolution doesn't get to say, and I'm anthropomorphizing, I'm personifying evolution now, giving it intentionality. Evolution doesn't get to say, you know, if I can just make 10 steps, the 10th step would be really great. So give me a break on the first 9, right? Don't give me any trouble. No, each step has to be adaptive, otherwise you don't have a very good adaptation story. There are things like genetic drift and allomorphies and so on we can talk about if anybody is a specialist in evolutionary theory. So I'm looking for a continuous evolutionary path that produces singularities. So the cause is continuous and it's evolutionary and adaptive all the way, but it produces singularities at various points. And we'd like to have a model of what mental operations developed along the path and in what order. It would be very good if we had an explicit account of what continuous changes produced what singularities and how they did it. And we'd like to see evidence from lots of different quarters that human beings now actually perform the mental operations that we are hypothesizing for that mental path. We'd look at them for intermediate steps, not for the function of language itself, but for the cognitive abilities that finally led to the precipitation of language as a product. And that's just what I'm saying. There was a run-up throughout mammalian history of integration abilities, and they got more advanced, and it was gradual. And when you got to a certain point, language could precipitate as a singularity. We would, of course, like to see evidence in the anatomy or behavior of today's human beings pointing to the history of these steps, just as anatomical evidence in today's human beings points to our once having had tails. So we'd like to see something now that accords with some of that history. And other things being equal, it's not bad to have a parsimonious way of explaining the emergence of many related human singularities as products that arose along the same continuous evolutionary path. So here's a typical network. There are various, blending is an operation. It operates throughout conception. There are a few kinds of patterns that come up routinely. These are just sort of reference points. Simplex networks, mirror networks, frame-compatible networks, single scope and double scope. Don't say when you encounter something that's a blend, well, which one of these 5 is it? Because blending runs over all conception, and these are just a few special points. It's sort of like, you know, 1 is a special number and 100 is a special number and 10 is a special number, but there's an infinity of other numbers along the gradient. Blending networks compress to human scale, and we've seen a couple of ways in which that can happen by borrowing a compression. So for instance, and you are digging your own financial grave, the digging of the grave is already compressed, and I'm using it to compress into a blend somebody investing and going bankrupt, which is very diffuse. Or if Clinton were the Titanic, the iceberg would sink, right? The Titanic, it's a very compressed frame. The boat hits the iceberg and sinks. You know, something hits one thing, boom, down. And I'm using that compression to understand a whole range of political stuff, lots of agents over time and so on. And, of course, I end up with this very creative blend. The one thing you know about the Titanic is it does not sink, but in the blend it does. The one thing you know about icebergs is they cannot sink because ice is less dense than water. They can be submerged, but they can't sink, but in the blend they can, right? So these come from the target, not the source. The other way, another big way, is to compress outer space vital relations into inner space compressed structure in the blend. So we've seen this many times. We saw, for instance, when we took the six milers from back beginning in 1954 up to 1996, and we put them on one track, these six world record holders, and compressed them to one thing. Well, we took the time and analogy relations that are outer space in the sense of between mental spaces and compressed them down into tight structure inside one mental space. Now, we just have one race and it's happening at the same time, right? We saw that in counterfactuals and words like missing. So I say put the pear juice in front of the missing chair, right? And you have an idea maybe over here that chairs should be equally spaced around a table, so you're just looking at the table and now you know where the missing chair is. This word missing is special. It says, okay, there's going to be some disanalogy between what you see or what you perceive and a normal conception or maybe a memory. And I want you to compress that disanalogy down into a special feature, and that feature is missing. See, now the chair conceptually is there. It just has a feature. It's missing. That's a compression of an outer space connection, namely the disanalogy, analogy and disanalogy, to an inner space feature. And we have language for that, adjective plus noun. It's like the red chair, the wooden chair, the missing chair, right? And we have lots of words like this, gap, mistake, accident, hole, right? All of these things are prompts to get you to compress an outer space network into a feature in the blend. Another kind of compression of outer space we saw is when you have analogies and disanalogies, they get compressed to change for a unique element like this. So here are analogies across all these spaces, these mental spaces. So that's what I mean by outer space, from space to space. And wherever there are analogy connections, there are always disanalogy connections. And these get compressed to change for an identity and even to uniqueness and change for that unique thing. So it ends up looking like this, right? Uniqueness and change. And we can use that for things like the cars get 3 feet bigger when you enter Pacific Heights. And we don't mean that when you drive into Pacific Heights, your car suddenly gets 3 feet longer. We mean what? Well, there are all these cars, and there are analogies and disanalogies across them. And these ones over here in Pacific Heights are 3 feet longer than these. So the cars don't actually get 3 feet longer, but in the blend they do, because you have change for a set instead of just disanalogy and analogy. The fences get taller as you move westward across the United States. The paint gets darker as you move down the wall. Now, of course, no paint is getting darker. It's just that the paint down here is a different color from the paint up here. So there's analogy and disanalogy across all these paint spots, and they get compressed to the blend. And now the paint, which is a unique thing, gets darker. It's very important. If you can't see that, you need to stop right there and work hard. You need to see when I look here, no paint is changing color. It's not, nothing is changing. It's static. But I can say the paint gets lighter as you move to the window, as it goes to the window. Right? Perfectly fine. Okay? We saw that caused motion constructions let us compress things to a blend. We saw that resultative constructions help us compress to a blend. We saw ditransitive constructions helping us compress to a blend. This is in our previous lectures. Now, there are a few findings of conceptual integration theory that are important. One of them is that the patterns that you see in category extensions, analogies, metaphor, framing, counterfactuals, grammatical constructions, things that have been taken to be very different kind of mental operations with different systems are not driven by different mental operations. These are all products of conceptual integration. They feel different, and we have to account for why they feel different and what's different about them. But what is different about them is not a difference in mental operation underlying them. Okay? Finding number two is that we are able to take a lot of these big networks and compress them into human-scale manageable blends. So we've talked about that before. And finding three is that conceptual integration networks fall on a complexity gradient. There are some that are way down at this end, like simplex networks, and we have no reason to think that mammals can't do them. But there are also mirror networks and single scope networks and double scope networks and a number of different that are more advanced. There's a continuum of difficulty in putting together these networks. We don't have any difficulty with any of them, but that's because we are cognitively modern human beings. For us, this is all duck soup. That's why it's so easy for us. That's why it goes without saying, but here I remark that no other great ape, no other mammal can do the things that we do. They have great talents, and we can talk about what those talents are. Okay, now, the central problem of language is that you have relatively few constructions. Grammar is very complicated, but it's nothing like conceptual complexity. If you had to have one word for every different frame, you couldn't handle that many words. You have to have relatively few linguistic constructions that you can use and combine to talk about almost anything. You have to have words like food that can apply very widely, or you, or I, or brown. Those are open class words. You have to have closed class words like I and you. I just said you. You is, of course, closed class. Constructions that have to be able to apply. So just take something like my cow is brown. Seems very simple. But think of all the people who could say that in all the different situations, of all the different cows, including things that you might not think was a cow until somebody said that. And how many different colors in how many different places there could be that this sentence would convey, that this sentence would be grammatical for. This could even be if a kind of cow becomes known as a brown cow, but then you get an albino brown cow, you can still say my cow is brown because now what it means is that kind of cow. Just vast, vast ranges of things that you can express in situations by saying my cow is brown. Think of the resultative that we talked about. You know, Catherine painted the wall white, noun phrase, verb phrase, noun phrase, adjective. Roman imperialism made Latin universal. He hammered it flat. I boiled the pan dry. These are all cases not of words, but of a resultative clausal construction, noun phrase, verb phrase, noun phrase, adjective. Well, the events described here in completely different domains. There are things like Roman politics versus blacksmithing. Right? He hammered it flat is from the domain of blacksmithing, and Roman imperialism made Latin universal is from Roman politics. They have strikingly different time spans, the era in which a language rises, you know, Latin becomes universal, versus a few seconds of an earthquake, for the earthquake shook the building apart. Right? Vast differences in the time scales. Right? Different spatial environments, most of Europe for Latin, versus the stovetop for I boiled the pan dry, right? Incredibly different spatial ranges. Different degrees of intentionality. Roman imperialism versus a forgetful cook versus an earthquake, right? And very different kinds of connection between cause and effect. The hammer blow, he hammered it flat, causes the immediate flatness of the object, but eating the meal one day causes sickness later through a long chain of biological events. And nonetheless, the resultative construction can be used to apply across this vast, vast range of different kinds of conceptual structure. So what theory of the origin of language do we propose in the face of these kinds of features? Well, double scope conceptual integration is characteristic of human beings. This is what we've got. It makes higher order cognitive operations possible, higher order performances possible. And the hallmark virtue of advanced blending is its provision of efficient, intelligible, strong compressions across a range of meanings that are otherwise diffuse and unmanageable. So you can take a word like food that applies, that has, you know, it, you use it to prompt for a certain meaning. But because you can blend that meaning with other kinds of things into something new, so now I can talk about bird food. And when I find a dish that some people are eating I've never seen before, it's still their food, right? Radically different things down here in the blend. But I don't need a new word, because food is projected down from the input space. Words, as we've seen many, many times in these lectures, linguistic constructions attaching to the inputs project down to the counterparts in the blend. So you don't need new language, you don't need new grammar to express new meaning. On the contrary, the language that you've got attached to the inputs gives you language for referring to the quite dramatically different, often things that are in the blend. So the development of blending capacity was itself gradual and required a long expanse of evolutionary time. Basic blending goes back as far as the evolution of mammals, as far as we can tell. And each step in the development of blending capacity was adaptive, from very simple simplex blends like framing to very creative double scope blends, which is what we can do. We, of course, can do all of it. Each step of the capacity would have been adaptive, because each step gives increasing cognitive ability to compress, remember, reason, categorize, analogize. And there is ample evidence of intermediate stages in the development of blending capacity. Some species, for example, seem to be able to do simplex networks. So there they are right now, and they can do what seem to have been earlier stages in the run-up, phylogenetic. Others seem to be able to do slightly more unusual simplex networks. If you take a chimpanzee, as Michael Tomasello has, working in strong areas of like food and dominance relations, you can see the chimpanzee working at the limits of the ape brain, maybe to understand that the goal-directed other chimpanzee maybe doesn't know what this chimpanzee knows. Working at the limits of the ape brain in those very strong areas. There's no indication that chimpanzees can understand that another chimpanzee has a false belief, for example. That's off the charts at the moment. But the chimpanzee does seem to be able to stretch a little bit. So right now, we see evidence of blending capacities that would have been earlier. There is also ample evidence of intermediate stages in human beings. That is, we can do simplex blending. We can do frame-compatible blending. We can do right now, and we do it all day long. We can do all of the rudimentary forms of conceptual blending. It's not just that we got the double-scope blending and then that's all we did. No, we can do all of them. A special level of capacity for conceptual integration has to be achieved before a system of expressions with a limited number of combinable forms can cover an open-ended number of situations in framing. And this is what we have. We, our language, what defines a full language is its equipotentiality. You can use the constructions you've got to talk about anything. This includes even little kids who have, you know, 18-month-old children who have relatively few words and relatively few constructions that they are learning. You know, look at Michael Tomasello's work on constructing a language. We do this through a whole life. We develop a larger and larger array of linguistic constructions. But even with the limited ones that they're developing, which of course they can develop because they are double scope blenders, they can talk about anything. You know, when the kid says, "Look, kitty," and there's a lion the child is pointing to, no problem. We can understand kitty is like food. The child doesn't know the word for lion yet, but it's got kitty. Points and blends the meaning of kitty with this thing, and now the word comes down, and the child can use kitty or kitten or cat to express what it wants to express. Of course, it will get better, but the point is, throughout human expression, we have equipotentiality. We can use the forms we've got to talk about anything, right? Somebody like Kanzi, the great bonobo, taps out at about 250 pretty specific tokens. That's it. Just cannot get past that. the smartest bonobo anybody's ever found, with the best human cultural support. Taps out at 250, the brain of the bonobo just does not seem to be able to go further, no matter the amount of support. The 18-month-old human infant blows right by that barrier as if it doesn't exist. And the reason for that is it doesn't exist for the human child. The human child is doing something very different. And the indispensable capacity needed for this kind of language is double-scope blending. Now, the development of double-scope blending is therefore itself not a cataclysmic sudden event, but rather an achievement along a continuous scale of blending capacity. So there's no cause-effect isomorphism in the origin language. The cause was continuous, but the effect was a singularity. Language arose as a singularity. It's a new behavior that emerged naturally once the capacity of blending had gotten to double scope. Language is like flight. It's an all or nothing behavior. Now, when you look at the evolution of wings from dinosaurs to birds, right? The story there is gradual. At each step of the evolution, it was adaptive, even though the thing couldn't fly. Each step was adaptive. It did good things. But you can hop and stay in the air because of the force you've given yourself leaving the ground. And you can glide a little, and you can hop and stay up a little longer because you can flap your wings like a chicken or something. There comes a moment in which you're truly airborne. It's a moment. It's a little teeny tiny difference. That's the moment at which you can stay airborne regardless of the initial force of launch that you had. And science knows many of these things. You know, a tiny bit more temperature and the ice melts into water. The variation in the cause is tiny. The effect, it's huge. It goes from solid to liquid. I swim in the ocean. I'm a surfer boy from Southern California. And, you know, if you have one more gram of fat in your body, you can float in the ocean without paddling. And 1 gram less, and you're going to sink. Maybe not quickly, but you'll sink down. Too many grams less, down you go and you drown. So we're talking about drowning versus living. Big difference in the effects on the basis of tiny difference in the causes. That's what we think language was all about. A culture cannot stop at a simpler language because, like, you know, oh yeah, we started working on it, but as far as we got was subject and verbs, and we stopped there. It doesn't happen. Because once you've got double-scope blending capacity, all of the ability to build linguistic constructions just comes right up. And that's so you will not find uncomplex, simpler grammars among human beings. And we don't think that you'll find them in the history of the species. By which I mean, not that suddenly everybody had full language instantaneously, overnight, woke up and had, you know, deponent verbs. But that the evolution is in cultural time instead of evolutionary time. It's going to come up relatively quickly. The story of the origin of language does have room for intermediate stages in the capacity. Blending is a capacity, and there are intermediate stages, but there are no intermediate stages for the effect because language is a singularity. Now, the hallmark virtue of language is its ability to use grammatical patterns suitable for basic human scenes to capture and convey much less tidy meanings. And we've been talking about this throughout this series of lectures, that, you know, if Clinton were the Titanic, the iceberg would sink, but also something like, she granted me my wish, which is a ditransitive. The basic scene is, he handed me the apple, right? One person transfers something to somebody else. That's what the ditransitive construction is built for, right? But you can say, she granted me my wish, which now uses the ditransitive frame, the transitive meaning, as a blend into this social situation. I can now say things like, the country denied me entry, where I'm taking a transfer meaning, but I put in a verb deny, which means blockage, and those two things lock together, and now it's the country. And entry is, you know, it's not an apple. Huge things, the country denied me entry, but it's okay. I can blend it with something I know, the ditransitive frame, and grasp it. That doesn't mean I'm deluded. I don't think that there is an intentional agent called the country. and I don't think that Intry is like an apple. But I have this human scale blend, and notice I have language like a ditransitive clause that's suitable for that blend, and I can use it to express the big network. Language in the strong sense is equipotential for these reasons. To say something new, we do not need to invent new grammar, and it's a good thing too. What we need to do is conceive of a blend that lets existing grammar come into play. Now, there are others who have come not that far away from proposing something like blending. Stephen Mithen talked about cognitive fluidity as the big breakthrough. His theory is very different from ours in a number of ways. You can look in the book and find out what they are. But nonetheless, he did say that what you have to do is sort of be able to combine things. The funny thing, for me about this theory is, for him, language is not an output of cognitive fluidity. It's not a product of cognitive fluidity. It's something that feeds into it, right? I don't quite understand that, but you can read his book. So this is sort of the wrap of this view. There are some fascinating individual truths about evolution and the origin of modern human beings that have been widely, if disparately, recognized, but they've never been brought together into a single coherent story. And this is the kind of story we are trying to tell. One is that biological evolution happens gradually. Another is human language appears in evolutionary terms very suddenly in recent prehistory, not long ago, as far as we can tell. Art, science, religion, and tool use also appear very suddenly in, you know, recent prehistory, 50,000 years ago, 60, 70, depending on what the archaeological evidence and how we interpret scratches on a bone or something like that. I have no time machine. I can't go back and get the corpus from 50,000 years ago. Human beings differ strikingly from all other species in having these behavioral singularities. And our performance in these areas is extraordinarily advanced, just despite the fact that we're a great ape and we have the common mammalian brain and we have the common primate brain, right? Share almost all of our DNA with some other species. Anatomically, modern human beings have been around for about 150,000 years. That is, organisms that look like us, have the same bone structure, move like us, things like that. But behaviorally modern human beings date from only about 50,000 years ago, but give or take, depending on the archaeological evidence. Okay, so we're looking for an advance in modern human cognition somewhere around 40, 50, 60, 70,000 years ago. There's no evidence of simple language in any other species. There's no evidence of simpler language in other human groups. Children learn complex languages remarkably easily, but they go through what looks like intermediate stages in the grammatical run-up. See Michael Tomasello. So none of the proposals we've ever seen before takes these as part of a coherent story. There's facts, big obvious facts that we should combined together, but there are anthropologists like Richard Klein, for example, in The Human Career, who offers the hypothesis that there was some kind of mutation about 50,000 years ago that produced a neurobiological change that made all of these behaviors possible. He doesn't have a theory of what the operation might have been, but he's an archaeologist and a paleoanthropologist, and he thinks that there needs to be one like that. And our proposal for the origin of language has ample room for full linkage across all of these singularities. That is, social cognition comes up at the same time as language, at the same time as advanced tool use, at the same time as counterfactual thinking. All these things cooperate together and help build. So we agree with Klein that the singularities are linked. We don't think that one of them caused the other. I mean, there are a lot of these hypotheses. Human beings got advanced tool use, and that made it possible for all the rest to come. Or they got language, and that made all the rest possible. Or they got social cognition, Machiavellian intelligence, and that made it possible for all the others. We don't think any one of these was the beginning and the root cause. We think instead that double scope blending is the underlying mental operation that makes it possible for all of these to come up. And so the book has got quite a bit of review of other theories and the discovery of mitochondrial DNA evidence that suggests that behaviorally modern human beings arose about 50,000 years ago out of Africa. Luigi Luca Cavalli Sforza's theory that locates language as an invention of behaviorally modern human beings, and he puts it about 50,000 years ago. All of this is covered in the book. So these new findings converge to suggest the rapid culture invention of a coordinated suite of modern human performances dating from the same epoch, perhaps 50, 60, 70,000 years ago. We've argued that all of these modern human performances, which appear as singularities in human evolution, are the common consequence of the human mind's reaching a critical level of blending capacity, double scope, conceptual integration. And although we do not have a time machine and cannot go back and verify this, we think from the evidence that exists now of the kinds of languages you can see, of the way in which children use language, of what we know about the way evolutionary biology works, we think that this is the best and most defensible hypothesis in the face of all this evidence. I give you just a closing sample, then I'll stop and take questions. I think we're okay. To get you to think about a few other realms that you might not think of as involving blending, just so sort of upset your minds a little and get you to think this way. So take something like writing. Now, writing is not the same as language, right? Writing depends upon language. Writing is at most 8,000 years ago, more like 5. Really, it's only in the last few hundred years that a lot of people have been able to read and write. I know of no theorist who thinks that there's a mental module that was evolved for writing and reading. You know, that still means that it took cognitively modern human beings about 40, 42,000 years in order to come up with writing and reading, and that's one of the great things about cultural invention using conceptual integration. It can take culture a while to build up to things. Once you get it, then the child comes into the culture, and because they have conceptual integration abilities, you can give it to them, right? They can grab it right there, and in fact, that's what I think is the story. The baby is born with its double scope ability, and culture standing right there to hit it with the conceptual integration networks that the culture has developed. Here's how you talk to your mother. Here's Chinese. Here are tones. Here's word order. Here's chopsticks. Here's Dragon Boat Festival ritual, right? And it can happen very fast. The invention of complex numbers took a long time, and the greatest mathematical minds suffered with it for hundreds of years. I can teach a 17-year-old who's pretty good complex numbers in a week, and they get perfect score on the SAT test. Not because the 17-year-old is a mathematical genius, but because you can give them, by expression, the conceptual integration network that took the culture a long time to achieve. Writing is one of those things. Writing hardly seems like a watch or a coin or a cathedral, like one of these invented things that we use in order to do thinking. But when we look at it, what is writing? Well, you see physical marks on a stone or paper or a computer screen, and these marks are circulated through the community. Now, by themselves, these marks are meaningless. We just can't see it that way. You can't look. I can look at the Chinese back there. That's not true. I still see the characters. But when you were a child and you looked at the characters, you couldn't see words, you couldn't see language, and you worked very hard to get it. Now, when you look at it, you can't not see language. But it's really just a bunch of, that's because you've got the integration network and you're living in the blend. But they're really just a bunch of marks on paper, and if I could send that sheet of writing back 50,000 years, it would be useless. I mean, the piece of paper would be a marvel, but the writing just didn't exist. They wouldn't have had the slightest idea what to do with the marks, right? But we have the ability to look at the marks and integrate it with what we know of language and to live in the blend. It's a compression. It's right here in front of you. You can see it. Now, suppose a woman is reading a letter from her fiancé, who's a soldier at the front. He's in the war. What is she doing? From one perspective, she's looking at and distinguishing marks on a sheet of paper. But a horse or a pig can do the same thing. You can train a horse or a pig. Was that culturally odd to say horse or pig? Do these animals have special meanings in Chinese that I shouldn't have used? No? Am I okay? Yeah, a dog or a cat can be, a pigeon can be conditioned to distinguish marks on paper, right? So that's not, she's clearly doing something quite different from the pigeon or something, right? And so there's one input in which the woman is alone and she's looking at a material object. But there's another input in which there is her fiancé and her general capacity to hold a conversation, right? These are very different mental spaces, but they get blended together in such a way, selectively, so that there's emergent structure in the blend. Now there can be a conversation in the blend, but it's a special kind of conversation. He cannot answer questions that she would put to him, but we learn in the blend that we can write, we can imagine what the other person might want to ask. And we can write, of course, you will be wondering when I will come home. And so the blend can try to build in some question and answer ability back and forth of the discourse up here in the general capacity of language into sitting alone with marks on the paper, right? So this is really, really amazing, okay? Notice there's no audible sound from the fiancé. Now, the fact that writing consists of words comes from the space of speaking and the specificity of those words and marks comes from the space with specific marks on the paper. So there are some marks here and some marks here, but these are different words because of the different specific marks, right? So when she looks down at the letter, she just doesn't imagine what her fiancé is saying. She looks at the marks, and the marks specify what the fiancé is saying. So the specificity, the general capacity to speak, comes from what she knows of her fiancé, but the specificity of the communication comes from the marks. It's projected down from the marks. And so, for example, you get a mark like boy, B-O-Y, and that's supposed to connect to the sound boy, or more precisely, there's a whole category of marks. Look at them, they look different. This one, that one, that one, that one, that one, that one. They're all different marks. But we take them as all belonging to a category and as connected to a category of sounds because different people can pronounce the word boy in different kinds of ways. So that's a great compression. High pitch, low pitch, British accent, Australian accent, Hong Kong accent, in a whisper, and so on, right? It's amazing compression. And a proficient reader ends up with a general blending template for writing and reading. And I won't go on with this, right? It seems to us as if we're just expressing ourselves through writing and reading, but in fact, these are elaborate double scope compression networks. And it's of immense cultural importance to us, but it cannot exist without double scope integration. But if you just step back a little, speech is the same thing. Doesn't seem that way, but speech is the same thing. Consider the scene in which the woman is actually listening to the speech of her fiancé, right? That seems like the basic human scene. This really works for us. We're human beings. We can do this. It isn't to say that we can't communicate with other animals to some extent by using sounds. That's a pre-existing ability. Now, he's come home from the war unscathed, and they're having coffee in the kitchen. Now, from one perspective, what is happening is just that longitudinal waves of air are striking her ear, right? That's what happened. He's saying, something, right? And that's what's happening. And notice when I go, blah, 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 I have different specificity, but it's not meaningful. It's not language. So I can make specific sounds and they can strike your ears. That's fine. That's one scene. That's what's happening. But in the other scene, dogs can understand that you're making different sounds at them. You can call them with different things, not even words. You can whistle, you know. So, but she's clearly doing something different than the dog is doing, or the pig, or the horse, or the chicken, or the bird, right? She's doing something different. She's not just hearing specific sounds, right? So we are categorizing the sounds in such a way that two sounds count as the same for the purpose of communication, right? So I can say boy and boy and boy and boy and fine. All these different sounds, they get categorized. Oops, okay. So you see the analogy. It's really just like reading and writing. In a way, I can go through exactly the same kinds of steps. You have to be able to make an integration network of two things that are very, very different in order to be able to have speech. Sign language is similar. I'll just refer you to Scott Liddell, who has elaborate examples of the way in which double scope blending makes sign language possible. And one thing that never gets talked about in, this is the last point, one thing that never gets talked about so much in cognitive linguistics is the concept of style, but I'm doing this because somebody yesterday brilliantly asked me, well, how do we include all the history of pragmatics? But I'd say one of the things that is common for human beings is all of their performances are done in a style. We typically do not recognize the styles in which we speak or the styles in which we walk. But just watch, go out on this beautiful campus and watch people walk and have framings for what's going on, who the speaker is, who the hearer is, what the purpose is, what's the nature of language, and so on. And this drives communication. So I would refer you to a book called Clear and Simple is the Truth, Writing Classic Prose by Francis Noel Thomas and Mark Turner, which takes the concept of style, and in particular classic style, romantic style, prophetic style, business style, managerial style, practical style, oracular style, prophetic style, reflective style, and so on, as a case of double scope integration, where what you're doing is taking a certain compressed kind of scene of communication that in most cases is not the scene you're actually in, and integrating it with the scene you're in, and this gives you a style of communication that makes not just simple communication possible, but whole cultural positioning for the speaker and the audience, much the way that throughout this entire last 1 hour and 8 minutes, you have so graciously been inhabiting the role of audience, while I inhabit the role of speaker in a university lecture. And you knew how to do it, and I knew how to do it, because we both recognized the style of our communication. Thank you very much.